Inigo's 11th Dream. At night, Macathran's grandiose rooftops shimmered like moiré silk as gentle nebula light burned through the skies above them. Amid that soft sheen, the streets themselves were sharp orange threads of radiance forming an intricate filigree across the circular metropolis poised beside the sea. Floating high above the crystal walls, it was possible to see a new radiance complementing the city's nocturnal luster, if you knew how to look. Far, far down at the limit of perception, the faint light was just available. Small wisps of darkling iridescence emerging from the apex of buildings into the balmy night air. They trailed gauzy tails as they drifted upwards. It was as though Macathran was exhaling a phosphorescent rain into the heavens. The souls of the dead called out in joy and wonder as they began their flight into the awesome abyss of night. He could hear their voices as they passed him. The relief at being free of the body, of pain and misery, the regret for those they left behind, the thrill of the song which summoned them ever upwards. They called out to each other, eager to share the adventure of their newfound freedom. Some formed packs, twisting together into brighter nimbi to soar above the clouds in an exuberant celebration of liberty. Others remained alone, reveling in their independence. Occasionally, as he cast his sorrowful gaze downwards, he could see some souls linger. Distraught at their death, they yearned to remain among their loved ones. Unseen, unheard, the frail spectres grew wretched and dissolute, as those they adored, above all, remained ignorant of their presence, the single comfort of knowing lost to false hope. Their grief was overwhelming, threatening to drown him if he immersed himself among them for any time. So he looked up again, at those who cast themselves longingly into the sky, wishing beyond reason that he could catch the faintest hint of the song sung from the heart of this universe. If he just strained, reached out. Ediard woke with a start, sitting up in bed, his skin slick with sweat, heart pounding, gulping for breath. Beside him, Christabel rose to put her arms around him. "It's all right, my love," she cooed. "Just a dream." "Every night," he moaned. For that was what he'd dreamed or been shown since his fall from the eerie tower. "Will this plague ever leave me? I'd willingly rejoin my old dreams in exchange for this curse." "Old dreams?" Christabel ordered the ceiling to brighten. Perfect white light revealed the maisonette around them. The sight of it, the normality, immediately made Ediard feel foolish. "I'm sorry. I always had dreams. But these..." "The souls again." "Yes," he said weakly. "I see them rising and I can't hear the song they're following. So I try and listen and..." He shook his head in annoyance. "Sorry."
"Stop apologizing. I'm just worried for you, that's all."
"I'll be all right." He flopped down and glanced at the narrow window. "What time is it?"
"Hours before dawn."
"Huh. It might not be a dream then. I always visualize the city at night." Christabel rolled onto her side, where she gave him a concerned look.
"Can you far-sight any souls right now?"
"Not sure." He closed his eyes and stretched out his far-sight. The dark shadows of city buildings slipped through his perception, fizzing with the sparkle of slumbering minds. Macathran's all-encompassing thoughts were easy to discern, pervading the structure of everything, but strongest beneath the streets and canals, down amid the levels where pipes and tunnels and strange threads of energy wove around each other. They were faint, elusive even, but tangible enough. Of the souls which he knew must be there, he could find no trace.
"Nothing," he said in defeat. "It's not a contest. You haven't lost anything."
"But I've sensed them twice." Ediard stopped to think. "I was close to the body each time, very close."
"What are you saying? You want to go to a hospice?"
"No," he lied. Christabel gave him a suspicious glance. "Hmm. I wonder if I could see the Pythia again." He didn't like the idea. Their last meeting hadn't been particularly pleasant for him. During the gentle questioning that had gone on for what seemed like hours, he'd felt awkward and defensive. The authority she possessed made him feel like a small child who'd committed some transgression and been hauled up before a loving but stern parent.
"What would she be able to teach you?" Christabel asked, with more than a touch of scorn.
"Nothing, I suppose." After that unsatisfactory meeting, he'd carefully read the lady's scriptures again.
It was the first time he'd read them properly since Sunday lessons at the Ashwell Church with Mother Laurelin. All he'd ever done then was learn passages by rote, never knowing their meaning. Rereading the scriptures was something of a revelation. They were hardly a religious text, rather an imprecise diary written in a very flowery prose, followed by what amounted to her thoughts on how to lead a better, more fulfilling life. Only the Sky Lords bound the two sections together, vast airborne creatures who sailed sedately between Quarentia and the nebulas, a migration whose purpose was unknown, but served to guide human souls to the heart. However, according to the lady, only souls that had achieved what she termed fulfillment would be taken. Reading through her homilies, he couldn't help but think of an elderly spinster aunt telling her relatives about how to be a good family. Be polite, be nice, be considerate, be charitable. Or maybe life was just very different back then, though he suspected not, judging by the diary part. At least that was interesting, though it only began as Ra caught his first glimpse of Makathran from the mountains. All the lady ever said of the ship that brought them to this universe was that Ra was leading people away from the turmoil which followed their landing. Beyond that, the past was never mentioned. She was admiring of Ra's perseverance as he broke through the crystal wall, making the three city gates. The wonder they all experienced that first time they sailed into the port, seeing a fully built yet deserted city where they could make their home. How, as they floated along Great Major Canal that day, a Sky Lord was soaring above the towers in Eerie. How it agreed to guide the soul of a dying friend to the heart which lay beyond Odin's sea. The lady went on to describe the founding of the city councils and the emergence of the guilds, and how other refugees from the fallen ships sought them out, while others remained outside the walls and grew jealous. The petty and bitter disputes between city and country over whose law should prevail. She never saw the end of those quarrels, the final treaty to enshrine the rights of both provinces and city. And her disappointment in the seemingly interminable squabbling was reflected in her later writing, the years when the Sky Lord visits became less frequent. When she asked them why they were abandoning humans, they told her it was because people were incomplete, their souls too immature to be taken to the heart. The lady felt shame for her species. Humbled that they would wither and die before the heart accepted them, she devoted the remainder of her life to elevating humanity, to installing a sense of purpose and dignity into life through her teachings. Along with a now ailing Ra and the last few Sky Lords to visit Makathran, she cajoled the city into creating the central church in Eerie. When it was done, when she saw the embryonic church swelling up out of the ground, she joined Ra on the top of Eerie's highest tower and let her soul slip from her body, so they could both embrace the guidance of the Sky Lord and travel into the heart together. No Sky Lord had been seen above Quarentia ever since. "That's good," Christabel said. "I don't want you to turn to people like her for answers. They're the past. If you're the person I think you are, the one I believe in, you make your own decisions." "Wow." Ediard stared at her, almost intimidated by her impassioned expression. "I'll do my best," he promised. "I know you will. That's why I love you." With that, she cuddled up against it, ordering the illumination down low again. "And don't think I haven't noticed what you've done to this maisonette, either," she added. "Ah." "It's all right. I haven't told anyone. This is Makathran. Even you should know by now never to reveal your full abilities."
"I do."
"Until you have to, of course."
"Right."
She grinned in the darkness. Rather surprisingly, Ediard fell asleep again. This time, with her beside him, it was untroubled by dreams or visions of any kind. In the morning, Christabel got up as dawn began to produce a glow in the sky over the Donsori Mountains. She dressed quickly and kissed Ediard goodbye as he lay drowsily on the bed. "I'll see you in a little while," she said quietly and slipped out. Ediard followed her with his farsight as she walked off down the street. Her gondola was waiting in the pool that formed the top end of Flight Canal and the bottom of Arrival Canal. A G-Eagle from Jeevan Station circled overhead, watching carefully, as she was taken to her family mansion. She would be let into the ziggurat by a small side door, and appear at her family's breakfast table, pretending she'd spent the night in her room, and every relative would maintain the pretense. Stupid etiquette, Hedyard grumbled to himself as he started to dress. His mauve cotton shirt had sleeves which barely came over his shoulders, while the trousers were the short ones he used for playing football in the park, ending well above his knees. The cobbler had shaken his head in dismay at the shoes Hedyard commissioned, complaining they were little more than lace-up slippers with thick soles. But the strange clothing was perfect for Hedyard's now daily run, as he'd known it would be. This morning he threw on a light sleeveless sweater, to counter the early chill air, and jogged steadily away from the tenement. With so few people on the street he made good time to Brotherhood Canal, then ran along the path on the Ogden side until he was level with the militia stables, where he cut across the meadows to the crystal wall itself. Golden morning light streamed through the crystal, creating a glowing barrier which curved slightly above him. As he pounded onwards, he felt strands of farsight wash over him, tenuous at best. His observers were trying to avoid being noticed. There were a few blatant scrutinies, accompanied by mental snickering. His routine had attracted a great deal of interest when he started it. The first couple of weeks had even seen kids running alongside as he left the tenement every morning. That casual amusement and mimicry had ended as he kept faithfully to his routine. On those early days, after finishing his mild post-fall convalescence, he'd barely been able to last half a mile before having to stop, red-faced and heart-pounding. Now he could do 45 minutes with ease. Asena, the Culverit family doctor, had approved, commenting that she wished more people would take their health seriously. Others in the city had been less charitable. Hedyard didn't care. Never again would he be so pathetically out of condition that he couldn't chase someone up a tower in Erie. Once he was back level with a rival canal, Hedyard headed back across the grass as the stable hands began leading the remaining militia horses on their morning walk. He crossed at the green and yellow slab bridge back into Jeevans as the district started to come to life, with shops and traders busy preparing for the day's commerce. As always, he stopped at the bakery on the corner of Farrow Street to pick up some fresh croissants before heading back to the tenement. Inside the maisonette, he stripped off and handed the sweaty clothes to his G-chimps for laundry. Beside the pool was a shallow oval-shaped recess in the floor, with a sheet of crystal curving round two-thirds of it. Hedyard stood inside and told the room to let the water out. A thick spray gushed down on him from holes in the ceiling. He rubbed some soap on, then ordered the water to cool slightly so he could rinse himself clean. These days he actually preferred the novel mini-rainfall arrangement to bathing in the traditional pool. It was a lot quicker and left him feeling refreshed, even after the run. After the comment Christabel made last night, he was wondering if he should extend the crystal sheet to make it big enough for two. Sharing might be a lot of fun. He met Christabel outside her mansion as arranged. The two of them took a family gondola across the city to Ilongo District, disembarking on the North Curve Canal opposite the North Gate. "You're happy," Christabel said as they started walking. She was wearing a modest azure dress with a simple white lace hem, and a broad green hat to shade against the warming sun. Her thick hair hung down her back in a single fluffy tail. "The caravan families are very good old friends," he replied, "and I really don't have a lot of those." They picked their way carefully along the tracks that wound across High Moat, heading for the caravan pens. There was a lot of traffic that morning, with carts laden with produce, herds of farm beasts driven along, and terrestrial horses cantering in and out of the various wooden stable blocks. They had to step aside smartly for carriages carrying nobility out into the Uguru Plain at considerable speed. "That's bad driving," Christabel said indignantly, as the third one sped past, cloaked in a mild seclusion haze. "I recognize the crest. It belongs to the Iversol family. I bet it's Coriel, off to their pavilion on Corbel Mount. She's started seeing Jamis on the sly, the third son of Upral, you know, the head of the Tarmall family. And she's the eldest daughter. There's quite a dowry involved. I've heard her father say he wished his family copied ours, for she'd make a better district mistress than her brother will ever do as master." "Really?" Christabel's eyes narrowed in suspicion. She rapped her knuckles on his arm. "Don't be a beast. These things are important. Those two families haven't been allied for over a century and a half. I'll try and remember. Remind me which district belongs to the Iversols."
"Lisieux Park."
"Okay." As he recalled, the park's master was a waverer in council, leaning towards the current mayor. He wondered if a family alliance with the ship-owning Tarmors would tilt the master towards Finnerton.
It helps, Christabel said slyly.
What does?
That the Tarmors support Finnerton.
Ah, Edyard grinned sheepishly. What would I do without her? He wondered yet again if it was the right time to propose. It had been weeks since the break at the beach lodge, and he'd done his utmost to make time for himself and Christabel at every opportunity. Yet his terror was now that she'd just think his only concern was time. It wasn't. There wasn't a minute of the day that went past without him thinking of what a life they could have together as man and wife. He sighed as he scooted round a cart piled dangerously high with cages of geese. There must be some event or action that would convince her of how genuine he was, how much he'd thought it over, and still couldn't see a life without her. Maybe if I just say that. But then what if it's not good enough? Oh, lady, why do you do this to me? Not that her scriptures were any help. The closest she ever came on matters of the human heart were, to look into each other's souls and see yourself reflected there is the true sign of a blessed union. The only trouble was, with the lady being so old, every time he recalled a scripture he heard it in Mistress Florel's voice. Talk about a passion killer. The Penzalong High Moat summoned up a real wave of nostalgia. This was the first part of Macathran Edyard had ever experienced. He remembered being overwhelmed by the sheer quantity of people and animals sauntering along the tracks. The noise and dust was exactly the same as that day. If anything, the traffic was thicker now. Three caravans were on their way out of the north gate, hustled along by the travel master's apprentices, who were trying to keep everyone moving at a decent rate and avoid jams at junctions between the various tracks. Instructions were shouted and long-talked, adding to the good-natured commotion. Two caravans had arrived first thing that day. Stragglers were still lumbering along in their big wagons, drawn by bulky, stolid G-horses. Edyard and Christabel fell in behind one as they approached the pens. Assessors from several merchant houses were already walking alongside them, small G-chimps curled up on their shoulders. Edyard remembered the little creatures with a fond smile. How the caravan families hated them, scampering up the crates and cages, examining produce with their oversized eyes and exceptionally sensitive noses, hunting for blemishes that had been strategically positioned out of sight. Edyard and Christabel arrived at the three pens which Barkas had been allocated, and stood for a moment looking at the wagons. Five were new, but Edyard recognized every one of the remainder. Ulrani's cart with pigs peering over the rear, as pungent as ever, though the Ulranis themselves always claimed they could smell nothing. The wagon of Dark Jarash, with its intricate inlays of claret-coloured wood that Goldthor chiseled in each winter. Olcus, inspecting the axle of his wagon, while his three young children ran about in gleeful pursuit of a whistling loop. Olcus, who gave Edyard a strange look, then craned forward as if not quite believing the tall young man in a jet-black constable's uniform.
Edyard! The man laughed joyfully and flung his arms wide. You backward village boy! By the lady, look at you!
Edyard grinned and foolishly stepped into the embrace, only to have the man's powerful arms almost crush him in welcome. He'd been slightly apprehensive at how they'd greet him, but Olcus immediately dispelled all his apprehension. The rest of the families were hurrying forward now, calling out salutations. He was hugged, kissed, had his hand shaken and his back slapped.
My boy! Barkas exclaimed.
Everyone cleared away, and Edyard put his arms around the old man. For once he was glad of the skill he'd acquired in the city at shielding his thought. Barkas had aged, disturbingly so. His white whiskers were thinner than before. The thick-set body appeared almost frail. He walked with the aid of a stick, necessitated by a pronounced shaking in his knees. But his waistcoat was still a colourful extravaganza of scarlet and topaz, with thin silver piping.
Good to see you, sir. Edyard said.
We have heard so much about you, Barkas said. I couldn't believe it at first. Rumors of the Water Walker traveled far and wide among the provinces, but we never connected them to you. And now look at you. His hands plucked at Edyard's jacket, wearing a corporal's epaulettes, no less. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. And yourself? How fares the caravan?
Ha! Barkus raised his stick in disgust. Look at this wretched thing. A stupid fall in the snow last winter, and my leg snaps like glass. Our doctor has forbidden me from riding. I must sit passively on the wagon's seat while my sons lead us through the mountains. The lady tests me sorely with so much indignity.
You look well.
Ha! Liar! But I forgive you. Now then, there is someone with us who is eager to meet you.
The old man grinned mischievously as he turned towards his splendid covered wagon, calling eagerly with long talk. Ediard took the moment to turn and beckon Christabel forwards. She walked timidly through the caravan families, unused to being completely ignored, but of course none of them knew who she was. Ediard had been waiting for this moment for a long time. For some reason, he couldn't quite fathom it was important to him that Barkus and Christabel approved of each other. He held her hand and turned back to Barkus, not really seeing the blue and white clad figure stepping out of the wagon. His smile was proud as he opened his mouth to begin the introductions.
Ediard!
Salrana cried, and sprinted past Barkus to fling her arms around him and land an effusive kiss on his mouth.
Oh, my darling, it's been so long.
Look who we found in Ufford, Barkus said happily. She's the one who's been busy telling us of all you've achieved.
Take me to bed right now, Salrana whispered in his ear with a hot breath. I don't want to wait another minute.
Every muscle in Ediard's body had frozen in shock and misery. Shame was inflicting a fair share of the terrible immobility as well. Salrana swayed back, puzzlement registering on her vibrant face and seeping into her mind.
Ediard?
He groaned. His gaze went automatically to Christabel, who was also standing rigidly, her composure chilling down to an emotionless stare. He had never realized before how similar they both were. Tall, slim, bright, lovely. But then he hadn't thought about Salrana for a long time now. His mind had conveniently pushed her aside. It was all too complicated. Something he'd have to deal with later, when the time was right. Everyone around them turned amazingly silent as they watched the reunion. They watched Salrana look at Christabel, and no mental shield was strong enough to cover up the dawning realization in her mind. Her shoulders straightened. For a moment the two girls simply stared at each other. Salrana put her hand out.
I'm Salrana. Ediard and I grew up together. Christabel.
The hand was shaken gracefully.
He neglected to mention that.
As one, the caravan families turned to Ediard, except for Barkus, who sighed softly and raised his eyes to the clear blue sky above. Ediard's far sight revealed a small city tunnel 5 yards below the pen. He really could make the ground open up and swallow him, as if he were some frightened dragon burrowing away from peril. It was hugely tempting, except that such cowardice would lose Christabel forever. He dipped his head in penance to his love.
I'm sorry. I should have told you that novice Salrana and I survived Ashwell together. Salrana, I should have sent word that I am about to become engaged. I apologize. My behavior is inexcusable.
Christabel's lips pouted as she gave him a curious look, but she said nothing. Her thoughts were none too steady.
I see, Salrana said, sounding as though she'd expected it all along. Congratulations to you both.
Come along, my dear, Barkus said, putting his free arm around Salrana's shoulders. I'll see you later, Ediard. That's if you can spare us an ounce of your valuable time.
Yes, sir, Ediard mumbled meekly.
The rest of the families abruptly discovered something else that they had to be getting on with. Olcus gave Ediard a scolding glance as he turned away, propelling his children ahead of him. The eldest old Rani lad produced a mischievous thumbs up before his mother shoved him along.
I'd like to go home now, Christabel said with fragile dignity.
Of course. They walked out of the pens together, receiving curious looks from the assessors who were still arriving. Ediard didn't dare say anything to her. He couldn't believe he'd allowed such a mess to happen. Putting off dealing with Salrana was probably the single most stupid thing he'd ever done, aside from not telling Christabel about her, of course. When they passed the end of a stable block, he suddenly grabbed Christabel's hand and pulled her off the track. She was too surprised to complain. Ediard conjured up his concealment around the pair of them as he stopped in the shadow of the stable's rear wall.
The seclusion haze simply wasn't good enough for this. He wanted absolute privacy. Christabel frowned as her farsight probed the psychic baffle. You're not supposed to know how to use that. Then she drew a sharp breath as Ediard dropped to one knee. Mistress Christabel, I love you more than I know how to say, and I cannot imagine a life without you. Would you please consent to marrying me? I know this isn't the correct way, but I don't care. I just want you. I will fight the Sky Lords themselves, if that's what it takes to prove my love. Ediard? I know I always mess up, but I don't mean to. Really, I don't. Yes. I just didn't know what to do about Salrana, so I kept on ignoring the problem. I said yes. I don't know what I was... What? Christabel knelt down beside him, grasping his hands in hers and smiling. I said yes. I'll marry you. Ediard's concealment faltered as he stared at her beautiful face. Oh, lady. You did, didn't you? She inclined her head slightly, proffering herself for a kiss. He touched his lips to hers, and nothing else mattered anymore. After the kiss, they just grinned at each other. Ediard slowly realized a couple of giggling stable hands were peering round the corner, goggling at them. Long talk calls were pouring out to their friends, as they gifted everyone the sight of the Water Walker and the future Mistress of Haxpen, kneeling in the mud whilst snogging. Yes, Ediard said, hurriedly rising to his feet. He held out a hand to Christabel. She stood and gave the dark, dripping stain down the front of her skirt a peevish look. Now Ediard was concentrating on his surroundings. There was quite a pungent smell of manure. A horrified examination of the ground revealed it wasn't just mud they were standing in. A mortified groan started up at the back of his throat. Christabel giggled wildly. Get about your business, Ediard snapped at the youngsters and put on a fierce expression. They fled, laughing all the way. Christabel hugged him delightedly. You are going to be the one who explains to our children how you proposed. Yes, he said meekly. She kissed him properly. There's no need to fight a Sky Lord. You know how I feel about you. Yes. He glanced at the worn grey planks that made up the back of the stable. Can we, Yes. She held out her arm, and Ediard led her away from the stable back to the path. I appreciate the sentiment, though, Christabel said. Actually, I'm quite intrigued how you would fight a Sky Lord. Ediard blushed. Me too. Do I ask your father now? Yes. She gathered her composure and looked straight ahead. And if he approves, he will put the motion before the upper council for a vote. Right. What? The direct heir of a district master or mistress has to get council approval for their marriage. It's a formality. It dates back to the Night House inheritance crisis 1100 years ago, when the master forbade his eldest son to marry a woman from Myco. He'd fallen out with her father, some dispute about unpaid cargo. He threatened to disinherit him, which the son challenged in court, so the master had the law changed. After that, the families used it to make sure the right people produced heirs. Nobody bothers with that anymore. The really important marriages are quietly arranged between houses. Law simply becomes tradition, but it actually is still law. Oh, dear lady, when I am mayor, I'm going to repeal every stupid law this city has and replace them all with something simple. When you're mayor? Ediard cleared his throat. If. You're serious about that, aren't you? Do you really think in this day and age I should have to ask Bice or even Owen's permission to marry you? I suppose it is unpleasant if you think about it closely, but I've grown up with all this, so I just know the way things work. It hasn't bothered me before. So, was your father arranging a fiancé for you? No, Daddy wouldn't do that. Not that it stopped other families from petitioning him, mind you. There were a lot of suitors. Oh. The idea of someone as beautiful and spirited as Christabel being married off to some dismal second son for the sake of dynastic status quo was repulsive. It sent him thinking about everything Ranelagh had said about bloodlines. Yes, that law will definitely have to be removed. Though he suspected it would take more than that to loosen the nobility stranglehold on Macathran's society. Why now? Christabel asked softly as they neared the North Curve Canal. Excuse me? Why did you propose now? I mean, I know Salrana made it happen, but I'm curious why she did. It wasn't guilt, he said quickly. Salrana and I were so comfortable with each other. We'd been through so much together. I've known her all my life. We were going to be lovers when she got back from Ufford, which would have led to us getting married, I suppose. At least I always thought it would. Then I met you. You agreed you were going to be lovers? Yes. Sounds like the country town version of our family arrangements. I'm not explaining this well. The point is, when I saw her today, I felt just terrible at what I was doing to her. I really have broken her heart, which is about as unpleasant as you can get. She doesn't deserve that. She's such a nice person, the best our village ever produced. But despite that, there was no choice. I was never torn between the two of you. It was you, and only you. She stopped and kissed him again. That's lovely, and very flattering, I think. I love you, Christabel, he said simply. And I love you too. So the first thing we have to do is go and tell Daddy the good news. And dear old Uncle Lorin the Bad. Right. He straightened his shoulders and took a breath. I can do that. We'll go and do it now. You understand, don't you, that after he says yes, we have absolutely no say in anything. If you thought you'd encountered tradition in this city before, it's nothing compared to what's about to happen. The formalities of marriage for the direct heir of a district master were scripted 1,000 years ago, and it does not change. Not even for Haxben and the odd mistress like me. Okay, he said apprehensively. Ah, you say that now. As long as you and I are together at the end of it, the city can do its worst. I mean, how bad can it be? Ediard arrived at the base of the Blue Tower in mid-afternoon and looked up at the tall structure looming over the Tosella district. Its azure walls almost matched the bright, cloudless sky above, as if it were attempting its own variant of concealment. As he walked forward, the shadows thrown by its huge buttresses fell across him. There was something about the Eggshaper Guild headquarters which always slightly intimidated him, and he was never sure why. He walked into the grand entrance hall with its dark red flooring, standing in the angle grid of thick sunbeams shining down through the lancet windows far above. A guild guard approached, wearing his plain white tunic under a pale dross silk jacket. Ediard gave him a wary glance. It was the same sergeant who had intercepted him on his first visit here.
Water Walker, the sergeant said.
Sergeant Yackel, Grand Master Finneton asked to see me.
A reserved smile crept onto the sergeant's face. I know. It's always best to turn up here with an appointment.
Yes, I've learnt that.
Please, Yackel gestured at the stairs. He is expecting you.
Ediard's constant running was definitely beginning to pay off. The long, winding stairs were annoying, but nothing more. His breathing was constant the whole time they walked up.
They say you saw Che's soul after he died, Yackel said.
I did.
Was he happy?
Ediard frowned. He was used to being questioned about seeing souls, but not quite like this. Not that he'd died, but he was content with what awaited him.
I'm glad he found peace at the end. There was a lot of hardship in his life.
You knew him?
The same way you did. I trained at Jeevan Station.
You did? Ediard couldn't help the surprise in his voice.
Yackel gave Ediard a furtive glance. I didn't turn out quite like you. But yes, that's where I served my probation and 8 years on the streets.
I didn't know.
You're not going to let us down, are you?
Let you down.
People have a lot of expectations now.
I'm aware of that.
Yet you're going to marry into the nobility.
Ediard stopped and faced the sergeant. I'm marrying the girl I love. The gangs will not benefit from that. This city will see the full restoration of law and order, and it will apply to all equally. Yackel pursed his lips and nodded in apparent understanding.
I'm glad to hear it.
Ediard knew the man was still skeptical, yet didn't know how to convince him, nor why he should make a special effort. As always, the view from Finneton's office was a huge distraction. Ediard managed to greet the master formally while Yackel bowed and backed out, He'd been worried that the height of the office would somehow remind him of his fall from the tower in Erie, yet his nerves were calm as he gazed out across the rooftops.
My boy,
Finnerton said happily, rising from behind his desk to shake Ediard's hand.
So glad to see you. And you don't have to ask. I will be delighted to be your nominee in the Upper Council when Julin introduces the marriage consent bill.
Ah, thank you, sir. He'd said he didn't care about the ludicrous formalities of the marriage, yet, as soon as a delighted Julin granted his permission, the household senior equerry had been summoned to inaugurate the preparations. There were the legal requirements. Julin had to ask the mayor for a ruling to introduce the consent bill before the Upper Council, which would be a week yet. The current session's legislative schedule was very busy. The Pythia was informed, and her blessing requested for the engagement. Then her staff had to find a time when the main church in Erie was free for such a ceremony, which wasn't going to be until autumn at least. Letters of notification issued to the other district masters, and by custom the guild masters as well. The official engagement party planned for the evening following the vote in council, which was usually hosted by the groom's family, but would now have to be at the Culverit mansion. Ediard had sat through the 2 days, 2 entire days, of talks with Julin's household staff arranging such things. Given his profound ignorance in such matters, his input was minimal. But still, he had to be in the room where a dizzily happy Christabel chattered endlessly with her housekeeper and stylists of the merits of various fabrics. For, given how important these events were, you had to dress correctly for them. In Christabel's case, it meant an entire new collection of evening gowns and a whole engagement wardrobe, while the rest of her family started commissioning new robes and fashionable suits. Ediard was taken to one of the rooms on the 7th floor, where a tailor who specialized in dressing militia officers was summoned to produce a set of constable uniforms made from cloth more fitting to someone of his new status. He was already dreading the day when they'd arrive and he'd have to wear them at Jeevan's station. Once the engagement party was over, preparations for the actual marriage ceremony could legitimately begin. Between then and now, the happy couple would be receiving invitations to parties and civic galas, which they would have to attend. A lot of invitations, and Uncle Lorin was to be their official chaperone at such events. Finnerton laughed at Ediard's broken expression.
So, thought of eloping yet?
Certainly not, Ediard said loyally. Finnerton just laughed louder.
Now you know how I feel about all the speeches I have to deliver. I'm addressing the Chemistry Guild apprentices this evening in the hope of a few votes cast my way. Will you be attending?
Christabel's expecting me. I have to help her select the music for our engagement party.
That's nice. Do you know many songs?
Only Diebold's, he confessed. Finnerton laughed again. A couple of G-chimps scurried in through their little doorway in the bookshelf walls, bringing trays laden with tea and biscuits. Ediard eyed the brandy snaps and chocolate chip shortbreads keenly. He'd never found the bakery which supplied the Blue Tower, but Finnerton always had the best biscuits in Macathran. The main door opened behind him.
I'm sure you'll remember Master Topar, Finnerton said lightly.
Ediard couldn't recall meeting Topar since his first day in the city, which now he thought about it was odd since Topar was Finnerton's deputy. And looking at the figure walking across his office, he was surprised by the master's appearance. Gone was the overweight frame. He looked a lot leaner, but not necessarily healthy with it. His face was haggard, the full chubby cheeks given way to deep worry creases in loose flesh, while his eyes seemed bruised. He still wore expensive clothes, a silk shirt and suede trousers, high black boots, and the traditional master's cloak, but even they couldn't cover the fact that he'd undergone a time of considerable hardship.
Master, Ediard bowed.
You've been making quite a name for yourself while I was away, so I'm told, Topar said in his powerful baritone. That, at least, remained the same.
Ediard shrugged.
How little any of us knew the day we arranged for you to join the constables, Topar continued.
Sir?
I apologize, Water Walker. I'm blaming the messenger. It's not been a pleasant time for me.
The three of them sat down as the G-chimps handed out the elegant china cups.
Partly my fault, Finnerton said, but you did come to us with an incredible story, Ediard.
Ordinarily, I confess, I would have paid little heed to it. A lad from the provinces exaggerating a few brawls, seeking sympathy to gain entrance to the guild. However, I found you pleasingly guileless, and Akim chose you as his apprentice, which really told me all I needed to know.
I don't understand, Edyard said.
The weapon, Finnerton said softly.
His third hand opened a drawer on his desk and lifted out a package of leather wrapping. It drifted through the air to finish on the desktop. Edyard froze as his farsight probed the contents.
Oh, my lady, he moaned.
It was a repeat fire gun. Finnerton's third hand unwrapped the package gingerly. Edyard gazed at the thing with utter loathing. The metal was tarnished, with ingrained rust corroding several areas, and the magazine had received several dents, but he would recognize the evil device to his dying day.
Where did you get it?
Where you left it, Topar said, at the bottom of the new well in Ashwell.
Huh?
That's where I've been, and as you know, it's not an easy journey at the best of times. I only returned last night.
You've been to Ashwell? Edyard thought he was over his life in the village with all its lost inhabitants. He really did. But staring at someone else who'd seen those forlorn ruins was triggering an avalanche of memories.
I sent Master Topar to try and confirm your story, Finnerton said, which, I'm afraid, he has done in no uncertain terms.
It was all as you described it, Topar said. The weeds and moss have grown over the rubble, of course. But I knew Ashwell as soon as I saw it. The cliffs, the old rampart wall around. Even the well shaft you hid in was easy to locate, though it was mostly full of mud. How you moved that capping stone is a mystery to me. It took us a day to break it up and move the pieces away. Then it was another week excavating the mud before we could recover the gun. He gave the weapon on the desk a scowl.
So now what? Edyard asked.
Now we've established the gun is real, we need to know about those bandits, Finnerton said, if that's what they truly are. What can you tell us about their leader? You said you spoke with him.
All I can tell you is his anger. He hated me because I'd killed his kindred in their ambush.
Is that what he said?
Edyard struggled to remember. It wasn't easy. For so long now he'd been trying to banish this very memory.
Friends.
That's what it was. He called them our friends. I was to die because of what I'd done to our friends.
Yes.
Interesting, Finnerton said. And how long between the ambush in the wood and the raid on your village?
Not quite a year.
So it wasn't an instinctive hot-headed response then. They'd planned it out.
Edyard nodded, hanging on to the memory no matter the pain.
They knew us. They knew Salrana, the one from the church.
That's what he said. I suppose they must have been watching us. I never considered that before.
Then they were organized.
Yes.
Hardly the kind of raid I would credit ordinary bandits with.
Their clothes,
Edyard exclaimed. The ones in the wood were wild, savages. They daubed themselves with mud, and they didn't even have shoes. But the ones who came to the village wore proper clothes, with boots.
And they had the repeat fire gun, Finnerton concluded.
They're not bandits, are they?
No, not the kind who have always lived around the edge of our society, Finnerton agreed, though I suspect they are allied. These are the emissaries of something else entirely.
What? Edyard asked.
I don't know, but they are relentless.
Finnerton gave Topar a small nod.
There were five in my travelling party, Topar said. Only two of us made it back to Macathran.
Edyard, I'm sorry, but the province is all but lost. Eight villages have been overrun, and that was when I left just before New Year. The capital is fortified and afraid, with families leaving every day. Farmers are deserting their land and heading to the eastern provinces. None of the caravans visit anymore. Their economy is failing. The neighboring provinces no longer offer help in any fashion. They are too worried about their own bandit incursions.
Edyard's head sank into his hands.
Witham? He asked.
Yes, Topar said. It fell not 6 months after Ashwell. Since then, the raids have increased. It's the same every time.
They wipe out the entire village. No one is left alive. The buildings are torched. The senselessness of it all is shocking. They're not doing it for anything other than the pleasure of killing. There's no reason for it. Tears were threatening to flow as Edyard thought of the pretty leather worker apprentice he'd met at the Witham Market. He'd never even managed to get her name. Gauche boy that he'd been. And now she was dead. Every garment or saddle or harness she'd labored over was gone. Her family murdered. "It's not your fault," Finnerton said gently. "Stop punishing yourself." "I should go back," Edyard said. "I should go with the city's militia and burn them out of the land they've contaminated, every last one of them. He feared me before, and by the lady, he was right to do so. I will bring him and his kind to an end, one way or another."
"Just calm down," Finnerton said. "There will be a time when we confront the bandits, and you may well lead that battle. But there are many things we have to do before that day arrives."
"Why?" Edyard snapped. "If you and Owen combine in council, you could send every militia brigade we have and order the provinces to raise their militias with us. An army could descend on Rulan province. These new bandits would be wiped from Quarantia forever."
"Where do they come from?" Finnerton asked. "They're not barbarians. They wore clothes."
His third hand lifted the repeat fire gun again.
"More importantly, where do they manufacture this? Do they have a city like Macathran behind them? Two cities? A continent? We still don't know what lies beyond Rulan, not with any surety. All these things we need to establish beyond any doubt before we embark on some massive campaign to tame the wilds. Such a venture will be deeply unpopular both here in the city and out in the country.
And if you don't do it, these invaders will be standing in front of the city gate within 5 years."
"That they will," Finnerton conceded. "This is the greatest threat we have faced since Ra led us here 2,000 years ago. I am deeply worried, Edyard. Something is out there, some society moving with a malign purpose. A society inimical to ours, bent on destroying us for no reason we know. More important, they have these lady-damned repeat-firing guns. You, with your strength, could ward off the bullets fired at you by one of these guns, maybe even two or three. But I doubt I could withstand such an onslaught, nor could many people. You talk of marching our militia against them. One man armed with this weapon could wipe out an entire cavalry troop. And they have concealment, too. We cannot send our militia soldiers against them. It would be slaughter on an unbelievable scale. Edyard, I am frightened by this. Do you understand? I do not know what will happen."
"Yes, sir. I understand."
"They're not settling," Topar said. "That's the strangest thing. The lands they have driven us from in Rulan are reverting to wilds. Weeds and grass flourish in the fields. Animals roam free. The ruins of villages are choked in vines and creepers. Nobody lives there. These strangers are not clearing us out so their own kind can dwell in our place. When we arrived at Ashwell, we had seen no one for over a week, and that was a week of hard riding. It was only coming back we clashed with them. Our luck was foul that day. Some lone patrol or spy saw us, and we ran away as soon as we realized they were after us. It was as though Honius himself was tracking us. They were unrelenting. So now I've seen these guns used in anger, Edyard. I know what horror you faced. The lady performed a miracle when she guided you to safety that night. All we could ever do was flee. And 3 times, even that was not enough.
"Then what are they doing?" Edyard asked. "What do they want?"
"I don't know," Finnerton said, "but it is imperative we find out." He stared at the broken gun, abhorrence glowing in his mind. "If we fail to stop them out in the provinces, then we will have to make similar guns just to survive. Can you imagine the carnage that will unleash on this world? The damage one man can wreak with such a gun multiplied 1,000-fold. For once such a thing is made, it cannot be unmade."
"It's already been made," Topar said bitterly. "We are not the ones at fault here."
Edyard reached out his third hand and grasped the gun. He brought it over to hang in the air before his face, probing the complicated mechanism inside with his farsight. In fact, there weren't so many components.
"Have you examined it?" he asked Topar.
"I have done nothing less for months,"
the master said. The whole way home I have studied it.
Is there some secret part? Something that must have come from the ships that brought us to Quarentia? Or could any metalsmith build it?
The mechanism is ingenious, but that is all. There is nothing out of the ordinary about it, no magic or impossible contraption. A competent weapons guild master would be able to fabricate such components. Even a journeyman should be capable, I suspect.
That caused Ediard to give the Grand Master a sharp glance. The long-barreled pistols from the weapons guild.
An ancient design, Owen said.
Yes,
Finnerton said significantly, though his mind was tightly shielded.
It could be they already have this or something similar in their deep vaults, knowledge or artifacts left over from the ships.
Is that where the invaders got theirs from, do you think? Finnerton allowed dismay to ease through his mental shielding.
I find it incredible that after 2,000 years, we have never heard even a whisper of another civilization on Quarentia.
Nobody has ever successfully circumnavigated the planet, Ediard said, or so I was given to understand. Maybe that's why. Maybe it isn't geographically impossible. It's just that nobody ever gets past this other settlement.
If they were that big and powerful, we would know of them, Finnerton said.
Perhaps we should ask the Watching Widow,
Topar said mordantly. Then he gave Ediard a keen look.
Actually,
I haven't seen any souls since Che, Ediard countered. In any case, wondering where they are doesn't help us. It's what they're doing which is the problem.
If only we could find where they come from, we might be able to know their full intention, Finnerton said.
He sighed. We're arguing in circles. It is my response we should be determining.
Perhaps a truce with Owen, Ediard suggested. Macathran needs to send scouts out into the wild beyond Rulan and track down the origin of the guns.
I'd go, he began uncertainly.
No, you will not. Finnerton said firmly. We need you here to complete your victory over the gangs. Once the city is consolidated, we can start to make more detailed alliances with the provinces. That's what Owen never understands. We can hardly command unity with the countryside if we're unable to instill universal law here at home. Yet that unity must come in the face of these incursions. That makes you vital to my campaign, Water Walker.
Ediard nodded reluctantly. After that?
When the gangs are banished, and if I become mayor, then it might be appropriate for you to track down your nemesis, though the lady knows how you will explain such an absence to your new wife.
Ediard flinched. He hadn't thought of that.
Sometimes you have to do what's wrong to do what's right, he murmured quietly.
Indeed, Finnerton said. In the meantime, I will focus on winning this damn election. That way I can lay the groundwork for the inevitable struggle which is to come.
It might come sooner than you think, Topar said. The provinces around Rulan have already raised their militias. Their appeals to the Grand Council for help will arrive before long. People will come to understand what is happening out on our western borders.
Not just on the borders, Ediard said. Ordinary bandits are everywhere in the countryside and growing bold. You will have to move decisively once you're mayor.
If, my boy, and it's still a big if, Owen is no fool, and he has a lot of support in the city. People like his one nation call.
But what we are talking about is the same.
Essentially, yes, but I will instigate it differently. Securing the city must come first. Without that, all will be lost. Owen is using unification to rally the city behind him, the city as it is. Ultimately, that will fail.
We're making progress, Ediard said. I have a new tactic which we're almost ready to deploy. It's a bit of a gamble, but it might help resolve the current standoff.
Then let us pray to the lady that it does.
Ediard stood, almost ready to go. Master?
Oh dear, Finnerton said with a kindly smile. This doesn't sound good.
I need a small genistar to scout round without drawing attention to itself.
An interesting challenge. I'll see what I can sculpt for you.
And I was also wondering if you know how to see through a concealment. I'm convinced the people who set the trap for me in Eerie were able to perceive me. Finnerton gave Topar a fast, bemused glance.
As there is absolutely no such thing as concealment, then there could be no way to penetrate it.
Yes, sir,
Ediard said in disappointment. Certainly no such thing as this. Finnerton's gifting rushed into Ediard's mind, a hugely complex methodology he could barely comprehend. I'll be sure I remember not to use it then, sir. We'll make a true Macathran citizen of you yet, my boy.